people will inject hyaluronic acid fillers, the same fillers that we inject for our patient and their faces and their lips and all of that, and we'll inject that into the penis. That does make sense. I don't do it, so I've never had experience with it. Safety-wise, it seems like a fairly safe thing.
I'm Dr. Veena Malik, urologist and pelvic surgeon. Today, I'm joined with guest Dr. Anthony Yoon. He is a social media sensation and holistic plastic surgeon with over 15 million social media followers. He's soon to be releasing his newest book, Younger for Life. On today's episode, we talk about plastic surgery. We talk about when people consider Botox versus fillers versus a facelift. We also talk about penile enhancement surgery, as well as breast implants and breast implant illness. We also talk about what people should consider if they're getting surgery outside of the country. As surgeons, we discuss the challenges of saying no to patients and also what to do with complications and how to handle those. Tony shares with us tips from his book. Specifically, he discusses how the skin is essentially a mirror into your health, how altering things like your diet and taking supplements can improve the quality of your health and leave you feeling younger and healthy. We cover what kinds of foods to eat, what kind of supplements to take, and we also cover things like collagen and red light therapy. Dr. Yoon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Call me Tony. We should be on a first name basis here.
Yes. This is really exciting. I have to say you've been so inspirational
to me.
And like, you are doing such a service to people by educating people on YouTube, and it is really wonderful. And I'm so excited about your new book. It's truly a wonderful book that everyone should buy because it has information in there that literally any human being can use.
Thank you. For me, I come from a very traditional medical background like you. You know, I have an MD from a medical school in the United States here, Michigan State. I went through general plastic surgery residency training. And really what I figured out in my practice was that there is so much that we didn't learn in residency, especially as a plastic surgeon. And what I wanted to do was bring out the information that I know from traditional medicine, but also that I've learned over the years from more alternative and holistic medicine too, and combine that in a truly integrative approach, which I think is a great way, especially when you're looking at aging and looking younger, to try to keep plastic surgery as an absolute last resort.
Yeah, I think that's great because, you know, we surgeons get a bad rap that we only want to do surgery, but there's so much more to it. And I think the best surgeons are the ones who keep their patients out of the operating room.
Exactly. And one of the things I've always thought is, you know, when we go through our training, we look at, okay, what is the cream of the crop? Like, what do you want to do? You want to do like the biggest operation. So in general surgery, it was the Whipple. You want to do a Whipple. It's a 10-hour cancer operation. If you are so lucky that you can do a Whipple, then you have reached the pinnacle. In plastic surgery, it's the facelift. And so for years, I actually gauged my success on how many facelifts I had. And I got to a point where I was doing so many of them. I had people flying in across the country. And then I had a patient with a horrible complication from one. And it set me in a complete tailspin and made me really relook at why I'm doing what I'm doing. And should I even be a plastic surgeon? And in the end, I realized just what you said is the goal that I was always thought was what we were supposed to do is the goal is to bring people to the operating room should be the opposite. It should be, how do we keep people out of the operating room, but keep them healthy and happy? And in my situation, feeling great about themselves.
Yeah, for sure. And you bring up facelifts. I think I did get a question on social media, like, what's better, Botox or facelift? Like, when do you decide that someone should go forward with a facelift? And nowadays you're hearing about all these liquid facelifts or non-surgical facelifts. So maybe you can shed some light on that.
So yeah, there are two very different things. So Botox is a neurotoxin. It's actually one of the most dangerous toxins in the world. And if you get just a tiny amount put into your body, you can die from it. But if you take the most minuscule, tiniest amount and you put it in a very controlled fashion into a muscle, let's say a muscle that creates your crow's feet wrinkles, then you can weaken that muscle for a good 3 to 4 months and cause those wrinkles to smooth out. That's different than a facelift where we're actually cutting out excess skin and we're removing hanging skin like jowls and excess skin from under the neck as a way to tighten the lower face. And so it is a big difference. You know, there's a lot though that we can do now with technology has been so kind to us with giving us all these avenues to tighten skin, to even remove fat, to enhance the complexion. Surgery really is something that we can save just for those specific situations that require it.
So there's so much technology. I mean, I can't keep up, right? I'm like a plastic surgery noob, but there's like lasers and radio frequency and red light masks and all this stuff. Like, what works out of those things? Like, what should we be looking for as consumers if we're looking to tighten up our skin or try to avoid maybe injecting Botox or doing other things?
So really, there's so many things that work. I think the question is going to be really for your audience is, what do you start with?
Okay.
And where's a good bang for your buck? Because yes, there are laser treatments that you can have like a 2-week downtime that can do wonders on your skin, but most people don't want to have a 2-week downtime. So the first thing that I recommend people start, they say, hey, I'd like just to get my skin better. I'm on a budget. I don't want to spend a ton of money. You mentioned earlier there are red light masks. That's a good place to start. So red light therapy is something that is very popular in more of the holistic alternative medicine realm. Yet you talk to dermatologists and plastic surgeons, and they don't really have much of an opinion on it. The idea behind red light therapy is that the red light, if you put it onto your skin, it's not proven. We don't know exactly why it works, but the belief is that it can help power your mitochondria. Mitochondria are the powerhouses of our cells, and they create ATP. And the idea is that the energy from that light, from that red light, it gets absorbed by your cells, and it helps to essentially energize them. Now, it's kind of this theoretical, you know, thing that we think this is how it works. But what we do know is that studies have been done on red light therapy and shown that, for example, there was one study that looked at, it was something like 1,200 patients, and they treated them for 90 days with red light therapy and found a significant, statistically significant improvement in wrinkles and skin hydration with it. They even did split face studies where you'd have literally only half of the face treated with red light therapy and found a significant improvement in the skin tightness and the firmness of the skin afterwards. And that was, I think, after like 2 months of therapy. The good thing with red light therapy is it's completely safe. There are a lot of ways to do it. There are handheld devices that you can do like a quarter of your face at a time, which I find to be kind of annoying because I'd rather just get it all done. There are tabletop devices that are usually pretty affordable. You can get them usually for a few $100s. There are these creepy looking masks that light up that you may see people on like social media wear. Those are great too. You can usually get that for a couple $100s, or there's even actually full body beds that some people do for red light. I think red light therapy is a great entrance point for people who are looking to use technology to look younger because it's so safe. It definitely helps, and you can do it in the comfort of your own home. When you're looking at going outside of the home, and if you're looking for a good bang for your buck, let's say at a med spa, then the first thing I would start with is IPL, intense pulse light. And essentially what this is using light to target dark spots. It actually will heat up those dark spots on your skin, cause those dark spots to slough off after about 7 to 12 days. And the good thing about IPL is that it's relatively inexpensive compared to more expensive laser treatments. There's no downtime to it, and it definitely works.
Can you use IPL for like under eye dark circles?
Not quite the same. For under eye dark circles, you have to look at the cause. The treatment should be targeted to the cause. So some people get under eye circles because they have puffiness under their eye. That's what I've got. You know, I've inherited puffiness under my eyes from my mom. And unfortunately, that puffiness creates shadowing that can look like a dark circle. So that's usually treated, unfortunately, surgically to remove that fat. But you can also get dark circles from pigmentation. A lot of people who are like Indian, they can get some of that where it's pigmentation. That's treated with more brightening creams. And you can also get dark circles from thinning of the skin. So people who have lighter skin, that skin is super thin and it can even become almost transparent. So you can see the dark blood vessels underneath. That treatment is going to be using, let's say, a retinol eye cream where you can create some thickening of that skin gradually to make it essentially less transparent.
I've seen also people doing like caffeine for like temporary, right?
Yep.
Temporary like brightening.
Yeah, so you can get tightness with the caffeine. It's kind of dehydrating. And so something like myself where it's a bit, it's due to puffiness, then caffeine can definitely help.
I know we talked a little bit about red light. The interesting thing about red light is there was this craze a little while back about putting red light on your scrotum.
Yeah.
Help with testosterone. Now, yes. Unfortunately, it doesn't work because it doesn't penetrate deep enough to get to the testicles. And so people were studying their perineum,
yeah,
and putting red light on their scrotum, which doesn't really help.
So, you know, the interesting thing, because I know the guy that they say, you know, there's these big muscle guys who go on social media. They know a study done by Ben Greenfield back in like 2007 or something showed that your testosterone increased when you know what he did? This is an article that was written in, I think it was an online magazine, or maybe it was even Rolling Stone, where he tried it on himself, and he saw an increase in testosterone levels. That's it. This is not a study. This is
a
one guy
that can improve his testosterone.
He's like, yeah, he's like a biohacker guy, so he's trying all different things. But this is like one guy. So you can't say that a study was performed by him.
Right.
This guy tried it on himself, and somehow his testosterone levels increased. But what caused it to increase?
Right. Right. You could have been working out hard the day before or that morning or who knows.
And that's not a reason to go burn your perineum. That's the thing. So
people do interesting things to their perineum. Speaking of, we talked about Botox. People do Scrotox, right? Do you see a lot of men coming to you for that?
But it's a very niche thing. And one of the things is a plastic surgeon, and you'll probably be happy I say, I stay away from that area in general. So I don't do female genital surgery. There's genital cosmetic surgery, labiaplasty, that's real popular. It's not my thing. Male genital surgery, cosmetic surgery is not quite as popular, although Scrotox, honestly, I think it's made news because it's just kind of funny.
Yeah.
That people think, okay, you're getting Botox to smooth out your scrotum. And some people say because it smooths out, it hangs lower and it, I guess, is more attractive that way or something. But the big thing they say is you got to watch out for those toilets with really high water because you could get wet.
Yeah, I don't know that women think a lot about scrotums, I'll be honest with you. But I think if it makes you feel better, I mean, this is, I think, how plastic surgeons think. If it's going to make you feel better, it's relatively safe. Like, there's no harm in it, certainly. But I think, again, you have to think about why you're doing it.
Well, it's like that study that was performed. It was in Asia about how attractive men's scrotums are.
Yeah.
And they had them list on a scale of 1 to, like, positive 2 to, like, -2. And +2 being attractive and -2 being unattractive, and every single scrotum was in the negative range. And so the idea is that there's no such thing as a beautiful scrotum. It's just a levels of how ugly they are.
Yeah. I mean, I operate on scrotums for a living, right?
You know.
I can't say I've ever saw a scrotum and been like, wow. In terms of general plastic surgery, what do you see men coming in for?
So men come in for a lot of Botox. And the good thing about Botox is it's a way to reduce lines, to just look a few years younger with that, if done really well, is hard to spot.
Yeah.
So number one thing is going to be Botox. The number two thing is going to be liposuction. And typically it's the love handle area and the abdomen that a lot of men come in for. Gynecomastia also, man boobs essentially, that's also something that people come in for. Those are difficult operations. I recently stopped doing them. I didn't get a lot of patients doing it, but I feel I did a really good job, but it's hard because expectations in that part of the body, it's really difficult for men. And I had a lot of men where you take them and they've had real gynecomastia, you know, real breast tissue, and you make them look quote unquote normal, but they were a lot of times dissatisfied. And what I found, it's kind of an unusual thing with male gynecomastia, is that a lot of the men don't want to look quote unquote normal. They want to look exceedingly flat and almost concave. And then, so then it gets into an uncomfortable situation where you look at a patient and go, wow, this I think looks very natural and looks good. And they go, no, I'm not happy. You need to take off more. You don't want to get into a combative situation where the patient wants you to operate, but you don't feel comfortable doing that. And they paid you money for a result that they're not happy with. And how do you deal with that situation? So
that's tough. I mean, I think that's the one thing as a plastic surgeon I always wonder is how do you say no? Like, when do you have, I mean, obviously there's some patients where you can tell there's some psychosomatic or psychological concerns there, but how do you know when to say no? Or what do you do when you say no?
Yeah, I've been in private practice almost 20 years now. That truly is an art form. Like, how do you take somebody who comes into your office with certain expectations and you turn those expectations down and you have them leave still liking you, essentially? Because if you let them down, they will go online and they can bash you and say bad things about you. And you just don't want that as a physician. So really a lot of it comes down to being honest with them. And most of the time when we turn somebody down for plastic surgery, it's because of unrealistic expectations. So they think that you can create something that maybe you cannot. In which case, you be honest and say, look, what you're looking to have done, the result you're wanting to achieve, I cannot give that to you. I do not have the skills to give that to you. And usually then people feel more comfortable. And sometimes I'll even tell them, I'll say, look, if you were my spouse or my sister or whatever, my family member, this is exactly what I would tell you. And I tell them, look, I make my money operating on people. And I am telling you, I don't want your money. You know, you got to consider that. Unfortunately, what happens is then people go to the guy next door and they're like, well, if nobody else is going to do it, I'll just do it. And they end up sometimes having surgery anyway.
I think the other thing people do is they go abroad. So
yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? Like, if someone is dead set on something and they're going to go abroad, is it unsafe?
So, you know, it's so important to vet your surgeons when you're here in the United States, but it's unbelievably important to do that when you're overseas. There are a lot of fantastic plastic surgeons in other countries. But other countries may or may not have the same regulations and training expectations that we do here in the United States. So that's the first thing you want to do is you want to make sure that that doctor has a sufficient training to actually perform that operation in a professional manner. Second thing you always have to consider is that, and this is something that drives me crazy, is, you know, I know plastic surgeons that say, well, I'll do, you know, if I do the operation, they're going to do fine. You know, I'm not going to get a complication because they're just that good. And you and I both know as surgeons, doesn't matter how good you are, you're going to get complications because the human body itself is not 100% predictable. The problem then comes in is even if you vetted the doctor, what if you do get a complication? What if you have to go to a hospital? Are you going to feel comfortable going to the hospital in that country and getting treated there? Do you speak that language? Okay. And then the final thing is a lot of people go overseas to save money. What happens that if you have a complication and you go to a hospital, your United States health insurance is not going to pay for that foreign hospital for you having a cosmetic complication. That bill is going to come to your door. You know, do you have the ability to pay that? Do you want to deal with that? And so all these factors need to be taken into account before you decide to go overseas. And for some people, it really works well for them. You know, I have patients of mine who are Korean, they're Asian, and they go to South Korea to get surgery. And those surgeons are really, really good at what they do. And they do great with it. But then there are other people who go to other countries and they just do it to save money. And then they come back here to the United States and they have drains in place and they go to the ER to get their drains out. And I take emergency room call at the local hospital, and it's not uncommon to see people who have had surgery overseas come in for their post-operative care in the emergency room. Talk about a bad use of our medical resources, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Like they can't even get their drains out. So I do want to talk a little bit about penile enhancement surgeries. So, you know, there's not a lot, right, that are actually good for penile enhancement. And I think there's a lot of reasons. A lot of men will say to me, well, you can easily get a breast augmentation. Why can't I make my penis longer? Well, it's not so straightforward. You can't just put an expander in.
Yes.
And you can't just put an implant in that's going to make it longer. I mean, we do implants for erectile dysfunction.
Exactly.
But that doesn't make it longer. It just makes it function, right?
Yes.
It makes it functional.
It's like the pump, like the Reebok pump. I'm familiar with those.
Yeah.
Not that I have it. My relative had it, so.
No, I mean, I do those all the time, and I think they're excellent surgeries for people who need them.
Yeah.
But if your expectation is that it's going to make you longer, it's absolutely not going to do that. You know, what are your thoughts on penile enhancement? What do you think in terms of the surgeries that are available and the safety of them?
You know, I think there are a couple of ways to do it. One simple way, and I don't really understand it, is some people will inject PRP into the penis and claim that that's going to enhance the experience and it's going to even add size, which I have never understood. So PRP, platelet-rich plasma, you drain out some blood, you remove the platelets, which are chock full of growth factors, and then you re-inject that essentially. Back in the mid-2000s, I think it was, that first came out and people started using it actually as filler. There was a company actually called Self-Fill. And the idea is that you inject it as filler, and the thought was that by injecting PRP, you're going to add volume to your face. And there are people who inject it into the breast, saying it's going to add volume to your breasts and then even into the private areas to enhance the experience. I do think that there's a lot of validity to using PRP for general rejuvenative use, and that's the idea of regenerative medicine. So we use it as like an onlay after microneedling of the face. There's definitely studies that show that injecting it into the scalp can help with hair, but it's not a filler. And it's not going to make those body parts larger. It just and doesn't make sense that it would because it's your own blood. Why would it make sense that injecting your own blood into your body is going to act as a filler? Makes no sense. There are people who will commoditize this and make fancy names for it. And then they have doctors pay them to use these trademark names and stuff like that to try to sell it to unsuspecting people, which I just think is not right. So what can you do? People will inject hyaluronic acid fillers, the same fillers that we inject for our patient and their faces and their lips and all of that, and we'll inject that into the penis. That does make sense. I don't do it, so I've never had experience with it. Safety-wise, it seems like a fairly safe thing. The one thing I would worry about is intravascular injection. And so what that means essentially is if you inject filler into an artery and you clog that artery up, whatever is supplied by that artery can die. And I did actually look this up. Has there been ever any case report of an accidental injection of HA filler into the penile artery? And I could not find any.
Not of HA filler, but there's been data on silicone fillers.
Oh, is there?
Autologous fat, things like that, that people have tried that have gone awry. I've made a whole video on this, but essentially there's a number of different substances that people have used as fillers, and a lot of them have been with negative consequences or left it lumpy. And I think that with the hyaluronic filler, what I've seen is that if you use a very small amount and you do like micro and then continue doing it for multiple treatments, you can have reasonable results. But my understanding is filler's doesn't last forever.
Yeah, I mean, you can get anywhere from 6 to 12 months. With a thicker filler, you can get up to 2 years, but that's not the one that I would probably use down there. I would go with one that's lighter. And then there's always a question of, you're going to inject them when they're flaccid, I assume. Mm-hmm. And then how does it look like, not when they're erect? I have no idea, but would that look different? I would assume it probably would. Is it going to look lumpier in that situation?
Yeah, people say the lumps smooth out. I don't perform it myself either, but I think if you're going to do anything for girth enhancement, that would be the only thing I've seen that's relatively reasonable, but the data's not very robust in that space. And then in terms of length, there's not a lot.
I mean, you can cut the suspensory ligament, and then some people put weights on the end to try to get it longer, but to cut the suspensory ligament, there are consequences to that.
Yeah, even if you do it safely, it just makes it hang a little bit more, right? You're not changing the length, you're just changing the way the corpora sit. And so ultimately, when you do get an erection, it's sort of less stable, so to speak. And so that can be sort of negative in that way. I think what probably does help, obviously weight loss is super helpful.
Yeah.
But also, if you have a very large mons, that's a hard location to target for weight loss. So have you done liposuction or heard of people getting liposuction
there? Yeah, so you can definitely do lipo there. Now there's non-invasive fat reduction treatments too that you can do into an area like that. So we have one called Sculpture that uses a laser to, essentially what it does, it heats the fat up to a certain temperature that causes some of the fat cells to die. And then your body basically excretes it. And so that's a very simple way to do it. A lipo you can do as well. I do that more in women, just because I do a lot of tummy tuck surgeries. And so sometimes I'll want the mons area to be lipoed a bit. Although when you do a tummy tuck, what I find is that when I lift the area, that usually negates the necessity for doing lipo for the vast majority of people.
What about jawline fillers? Like, guys want a more angular looking jaw? Are there fillers or are there things that you can do for that?
So there actually is a filler that recently got FDA approved for the jaw. Juvederm Volux, I think is the name of it. I don't really use it that much. So I don't do a ton of fillers in my office anymore just because I'm busy doing surgery. And the problem with the jawline is that you've got the facial artery that runs right along there. And the last thing you want to do is fill the facial artery with some HA filler. You know, you've got to be so careful when you're talking about filler specifically, especially in the face, because there have been people who have had filler accidentally injected into parts of the face where they've lost parts of their nose, parts of their lip. In my book, I tell a story of a patient where it's like an extreme situation in a way. Like, she was a younger woman, had nasal labial folds, which are the creases, the smile lines that go from the nose to the sides of the mouth. And she came to see me for these injections. No, you know, usually it's very common, no big deal. And right before we were going to treat her, the power went out in my office building. And I said, the power's out. You know, we'll probably have to have you come back again. And she goes, no, I've driven an hour and a half for this. Can you just move me by the window and just inject me there? So against my better judgment, I was like, well, she came an hour and a half. Let me just do it. So I injected her. And this was many years ago where we didn't have cannulas. We only had needles to inject with. And I got an intravascular injection. I injected it into part of her facial artery. It's a horrifying situation. She's a beautiful 20-some-year-old woman. Honestly, it was my fault. Like, the technique was not great, and this happens. And so we have a lot of things that we can do: hyperbaric oxygen, injected hyaluronidase, which basically melts away the filler, nitropaste, all these different things. I put her on heparin sub-Q, and I was able to essentially salvage the situation, but I was very lucky. And so you got to consider with fillers, you know, Botox is one thing. Worst case scenario, you get a bad Botox job, your face looks funny, you get a droopy eyelid or something like that for a few months. You know, you get a complication from filler, and that can be devastating. And so you really want to be careful with filler. And that's why, you know, I had people ask, well, hey, can you inject filler into my penis? And I'm like, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen if you inject that into the penile artery? Could you literally necrose the end of your penis? And so I was curious if I've ever seen any, you know,
I haven't seen
proof of that. But theoretically, I suppose that could happen. You know, there are people who've gone blind from injections of filler when filler is injected into their nose or into the nasolabial folds. You know, you got to be very careful.
I think it's very humbling that you can openly talk about your complications. A lot of surgeons can't do that. And I just want to commend you for doing
because
it is really hard to do.
Well, I think that really, there's two things. You know, if you haven't had complications, it's not that you're that good. It's that you haven't operated enough. And I think that the difference between a good surgeon and a bad surgeon is not how many great results they get. It's how do they deal with the not so great result?
Yeah.
And I think that's the key, because in my field, I see so many people that say, oh, I had surgery with this guy and he won't see me afterwards and I've got a complication or something. And it baffles me that doctors can actually do that.
Oh my gosh.
You know, that they can turn their back on patients because they've already been paid and not care.
Right.
It's shocking.
It's really sad. It happens in urology too. And I think, you know, you've sort of alluded to this, but there is no minor procedure, right? There is no thing that I'm going to do to you that might have zero complication, right? I mean, even walking across the street has a complication rate. You get hit by a car, right? So I think that that's one thing as surgeons is very humbling to deal with complications, but also it's dealing with the patient after you've had a complication. Like you'd be saying, you know, I'm wrong. I messed up. I made a mistake. I want to help you get through this, and dealing with their family. And that's really tough to do, but also to talk on a public forum about the ways that you've had errors is really hard. And I think that I wish more people did it, because we all have these situations. We're all there, and it can be very isolating and very lonely when you have a complication. But to be able to see other people talking openly.
Yeah, and I think that's what patients need from us. You know, they need us to be their advocate and to be honest with them. And shockingly, you think that that is basic as a doctor, is honesty. And unfortunately, in the field of plastic surgery, there's so much, whether it's chasing fame, chasing clout, chasing money, there's so many other things that are pushing you to act a certain way that people lose sight of what's really the most important thing, and it's taking good care of your patients.
Yeah, and I think to be fair, some people just don't know how to cope. Like, I don't think it's always that they're a bad person or that they just literally, like their reaction, their knee gut reaction is to run away from the thing that's scaring them. And that's dealing with a complication, right? It's hard. Like, I'm sure you had trouble talking to that patient afterward. I can remember so many times where I've had a complication, whether it's small or big, and having to push myself to do rounds that day and really force myself to take those steps and like look that patient in the face and say, I'm sorry. It happens to everybody. And I think it's something you grow into, but no one talks about it enough. Mm-hmm. And being a surgeon, part of the job.
Yeah, I think that's where coming back to the whole idea of using plastic surgery as a last resort, I wanted to make sure, you know, in the end, when I started seeing like, what should I do with my career? It's like, I feel like I could help so many more people non-surgically than I can by putting them under the knife. And there's so many people who can help feel better about themselves and be healthier by going this different route. And that's why I've done that.
No, and I'm so excited to talk about that. But before we do, I just want to cover a couple more questions that I've gotten from our audience. Breast implants. People love to talk about breast implants. So, I mean, there's a lot of controversy, right? There's breast implant illness, and I don't really know. I've certainly seen patients who've had issues with implants. How do you know, like, who's at risk for that? And what do you do if you have to remove a breast implant?
So yeah, the history of implants is pretty interesting. So, you know, they've been around for a long time. In the 80s and 90s, they were real popular, silicone implants. And then in 1992, the FDA instituted a moratorium on silicone implants because there was this big uproar of women who thought that they were getting sick from their implants. So Dow Chemical went bankrupt. There were class action lawsuits. And they were only allowed to be used, technically, the silicone implants in an FDA-approved study. From 1992 all the way up to 2006, the only implants you could use were saline. In November of 2006, the FDA lifted the moratorium after looking at the early studies and said, hey, the implants should be safe to use. And this was really looked at from plastic surgeons as essentially a stamp of approval that implants are safe and they don't make people sick. And I went through my training during part of that time. And so I was always taught the dogma is that breast implants don't make you sick. And people who think that they make them sick, it's because of something else, maybe even psychiatric problems. And so that was dogma for many, many years until the onset of Facebook groups, actually. There was a couple of websites that opened up of women who would congregate saying, I've got all these symptoms that I think are from my breast implants, like brain fog, fatigue, joint aching, hair loss, rashes, and all this stuff. And the website started popping up and they got some attention, but it wasn't until social media really got popular that there are these groups now, Facebook groups, that would end up having tens of thousands of members of women saying, I've had implants, I've had all these symptoms, nobody could figure it out, and then I had my implants taken out, and I feel so much better. I started looking at that and I started wondering, well, wait a minute, you know, the dogma, I've always taught that it isn't real. And so I looked at the studies in our plastic surgery literature and those all supported, you know, that there was no connection there. But then I went to the websites of the women setting up these sites and I looked at their citations, their scientific articles that they cited. And I'd never heard of these articles before. And it was in the rheumatology literature and journals that we don't read. And I started thinking, there's something to this. When you see that, you know, when you have a person with all these symptoms and all their testing comes back negative and they get their implants taken out and there's anywhere from 55 to 85% reduction in their symptomatology afterwards, there's got to be something to it. And so after going through that, I was one of the first plastic surgeons on social media to basically proclaim that I think breast implant illness is real. And I faced a lot of criticism after that. I was actually rising up in the ranks in our societies. And I was almost to the point where I was going to be a board member, potentially even on track to become a future president. And in the span of literally like 6 months, I lost all my committee assignments and I was persona non grata. And I had doctors calling me and saying, you got to shut up about this stuff. Like, you know, people are not happy with what you're saying. So when you look at the actual literature in plastic surgery, we look as surgeons, we look at immediate surgical complications, capsular contracture, hematoma, infection, stuff like that. We never really look that closely at, does somebody a year or 2 years later have hair falling out after implants? Like that was never something they really looked at. And so even though the studies didn't show a lot of that, they didn't really look for it. And then you look at the studies and like who's funding the studies, who's performing the studies. A lot of these plastic surgeons are paid hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars from implant companies. And so they have a financial incentive to say that implants are safe. And I know plastic surgeons myself who, when I came out with this, they were not happy with me. For example, I got a local TV crew asked me, hey, you know, we want to do an interview with you about BII. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I want to talk about it. It's so controversial. And another plastic surgeon, I told him, I'm thinking about going on and talking about this. And he goes, well, you got to tell them it's BS, right? And it's like, this person's younger than me. They don't have as much experience, but they believe the dogma. So in the end, my belief with implants is that the numbers I told you are true. You know, if you have somebody with these symptoms, they have implants, anywhere from 55 to 85% of them will achieve a significant reduction in their symptomatology afterwards. But we don't know why. That's the thing. Is it due to the implants? Is it psychological? Is it a combination of both? We don't know. And so what do we have to do? Our number one priority is to listen to our patients and do what's best for them. And so now I tell all my patients, and I do breast implants and I take them out. I tell them that this is a possibility. We don't even know what percent risk you're at, but the studies are now being performed.
Yeah. So similarly in urology and urogynecology with mid-urethral slings for stress incontinence. So the mesh product placed underneath the urethra for people who are leaking. And similarly, there are people who complain that they're having symptoms that are very rheumatologic in nature from their sling that get improved after they're removed. And so there's been, you know, a couple colleagues or mentors of mine who really believed these and taken them out and patients have gotten better. But it's still very much in its infancy. And I would say there's many, many people who do well, just like there's many, many women who do well with implants. But there's certainly a very small subset who have a weird reaction. Yeah. And I'm certain I'm going to get some negative blowback from talking about this, but I think we have to listen to our patients. And I think it's super valuable to do that. And all of education, all of our treatment paradigms come from asking questions, right? And from challenging the status quo.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to do that.
Yeah, and I think it is. And really, we owe it to our patients in the end, to be honest. And so I think that's what upsets me is when you have physicians who don't want you to speak up your mind and your opinion. You know, when I talk about BII, I don't state it as if I am like the ultimate authority, and because we don't know, but I'll tell you what I believe,
right?
You know, and I'll say that I think it's real, but at the same time, if somebody believes it's not, I'm not going to argue with them. Like, that's fine. But in the end, what it really comes down to when people say, oh, you got to be quiet about it, I don't care what they say about me. In the end, I've got to do what I feel is right.
Yeah.
And it's always keeping really the number one thing is what's best for your patients. As long as whatever you put out there, you feel is best for your patient or your follower, you know, from a health perspective, as long as you're following that, you know, you're going to put out good information.
Yeah. And I think just admitting that we don't know everything, right? And there's so much to learn.
Yeah.
So I want to start talking about your book. You talk about auto-rejuvenating.
Auto-juvenation. Auto-juvenation, yes.
Not auto-rejuvenation.
It's a term that I've come up with, so it's understandable.
I was going to ask you, is this like a known term or something you use for your book?
No. So really what it came down to is I had this patient who had a terrible complication, and it really caused me to relook at what I'm doing with my life and my career. And am I really doing people a service by performing surgery? What I ended up doing is I spent a lot of time focusing. You know, so interestingly, if you look at aging of the skin and you ask, let's say, a holistic or an alternative practitioner, what can I do to have beautiful, healthy skin? They'll say, heal your gut. You know, the gut, there's a gut-skin axis there. There is a direct communication. If you heal your gut, you're going to have beautiful skin. If you ask a dermatologist, what can I do for healthy, beautiful skin? They'll say, wear sunblock and try a retinoid. If you ask a plastic surgeon, they'll probably say, get Botox injections and laser treatments, maybe a facelift. So really what I wanted to do and what I really came down to is I realized that the best way to turn back the clock and get healthy, beautiful skin is a true inside-outside approach, which is also kind of an East and West approach. And so the idea then is you want, and the way I describe it, it's really focusing on five main things. So it's going to be what you eat, when you eat, supplements that you may take, skincare products, and then optional would be a non-invasive treatments. And so what we ended up doing, just for example, we have a 21-day jumpstart where we took a certain amount of people, we put them through literally just 21 days, 3 weeks, where we put them on a certain type of diet, an anti-inflammatory collagen-supporting diet. We had them intermittent fast for 2 days a week for weeks 2 and 3. We put them on a certain number of supplements, all very basic stuff, and then a very simple skincare routine. And we looked at how they did after 21 days, and all of them had a significant improvement in the health of their skin and the quality of their skin. And they had people telling them, wow, your skin looks great. What are you doing? Even though they didn't know that they were on this program. And so autorejuvenation is this concept I came up with where you essentially use your body's own regenerative abilities to rejuvenate itself. And it's not having to go under the knife, but it's once again, making simple changes in diet. And once again, adding a little bit of intermittent fasting, taking the right supplements, and then once again, skincare. And really the vast majority of people can get big, big changes in their skin that way.
I love the way you described it. You said that it was sort of, not your exact words, but like your skin is a window into your health, right?
It really is.
So it really, like looking at your skin is a view of how you're aging. Mm-hmm. And you described in there signs of premature aging. So can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, really the skin is called, it's a magic mirror. So you are seeing what's going on the inside, on the outside. And some signs, you know, when I get patients come in my office, and you may be able to too, you can spot who's a smoker the moment they come in because you don't want to operate on smokers, but you can tell by their skin. I can get an idea of the type of diet they have if they have a very inflammatory diet because you can see the inflammation in their skin. And then there's the opposite. You have people who come in and like I look at you and I can tell that you have a healthy overall lifestyle. And part of it is you look at the color of your skin. It's very even, but you have kind of rosy pink cheeks, but not overly rosy and inflamed looking, you know, with lesions and eczema and stuff like that. And so really, it's that magic mirror is the idea. And so what we try to do, you know, when you look at kind of overall beauty, I think what people think that beauty is makeup, it's plastic surgery, it's filler and stuff like that. But what true beauty really is health. That's the first step to feeling beautiful and overall looking beautiful on the outside. And that's what we try to start with.
I love that. That is really, really valuable. It's everything you do. People always want a quick fix, right? They want the filler, the Botox, the laser treatment, and they want to look great immediately and they don't want to do the hard work. But actually living a healthy lifestyle is challenging.
It can be, but I think it's not as hard as some people think. So making some simple changes can make huge impacts. So when you look at overall a diet, first thing I recommend is just try to reduce the amount of sugar that you eat. So sugar really is a great ager of our skin, and it ages our skin through the process of glycolysis, where the sugar will actually bond to the collagen of our skin, causing it to become kinked and denatured and technically older, also causing chronic inflammation. Now, we are in a society where 20% of our calories come from sugar-sweetened drinks, whether it's soda pop or energy drinks or even fruit juices. You know, that's a really easy place to start, you know, and so for your listeners who, let's say, are drinking 3 cans of soda pop a day, if you reduce that from 3 to 2, that's a big, big deal. Even better, if you reduce it from 3 to 2 and you substitute that can of soda pop for, let's say, kombucha or for, let's say, green tea, now you're actually going to take forward steps to even help to improve your health and the health of your skin. So really simple steps like reducing the amount of sugar that you eat, maybe trying to focus on eating the rainbow of fruits and vegetables because of the antioxidants. Antioxidants fight free radicals or oxidation. That's a big ager of our skin as well. And you fight that with antioxidants. The antioxidants are the actual pigments in the fruits and vegetables. So if you eat, let's say, a green leafy vegetable, you get different antioxidants than if you eat, let's say, an orange, which is different than if you eat, let's say, a yellow banana. And so ideally, by eating the rainbow of colors, you're going to get a variety of antioxidants that can fight off oxidation and free radicals and make your skin healthier too.
Yeah, I love that. I think you talked about a couple things that were maybe inflammatory or maybe have negative impacts on your diet, things like gluten, soybean oil, and dairy. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, so gluten is interesting because in traditional medicine, we think, okay, if you're not celiac, you should be fine with gluten. You know, studies are questionable. So 1% of the population is celiac, and people who have celiac literally cannot tolerate gluten. That's a different situation than people who may be gluten sensitive. And I would guess that that may be closer to 10% or even more of the population. The idea behind gluten, and really with gluten, it's something that I recommend doing more of an elimination type of a trial. For some people, gluten can be very inflammatory. And some people who have chronic pain, like chronic joint pain and things like that, what we find in some people that they have the sensitivity to gluten and it can create almost an autoimmune reaction for some of them. And so one of the things that I do in this 21-day jumpstart is I take people off of certain foods that may be inflammatory to your system and see how you do off of it. So gluten, dairy, ultra-processed foods, you know, those foods that are like chips and like cupcakes and those types of foods that are pre-packed and that last for forever on the shelf, those are things that you want to go off of. And really what you find is that there are foods that people routinely eat and they may make them feel crummy, but because they've been eating them for so long, because it's such kind of a staple in the standard American diet, that they don't know potentially how great they can feel until they go off of it. And that's what you find is many people. And so, you know, I put stuff out there, well, you know, just try going 2-3 weeks off of gluten and see how you feel. And there are all these comments, let's say on my YouTube community page where people go, oh my gosh, I went off gluten and my joint pains went away, my rashes cleared up, my skin looked better. It's not everybody. There's some people who do just fine with gluten, but just try it. Same thing with dairy. I had a family member of mine who was having some health issues as a child, and we took that person off, that kid off dairy, which in traditional pediatrics, like, no, you got to feed your kids milk. And we took them off dairy and those symptoms went away. They were neurologic issues.
Oh.
And so, you know, I think that there's something called bioindividuality where we all react a little, potentially a little differently. The BII, that could explain what you're talking about with the implant that you have in patients who may have issues, where certain things impact some people a certain way that may not impact others. And traditional medicine is really good at doing large studies where we can say, hey, the majority of people, if they're in this parameter, should do fine. If they're outside of it, they may not do fine. But that doesn't necessarily explain the individuality of each patient, where maybe a high normal for one patient is really abnormal for them, where it could be just fine for somebody else.
Yeah. No, and that's super valuable because I think even the way we process diet, I mean, you know this, Asians are more lactose intolerant. We don't have the right enzymes to process dairy and we sometimes habituate to it. So we're okay, but a lot of us can't tolerate dairy. And so probably for whatever reason, we've adapted to be that way.
Yeah. And I think that there's, you know, things that have come up overall, you know, when you look at the overall diet and the standard American diet, and it's so different. You know, I grew up in middle Michigan in a tiny town, and my family was the only Asian family in town. And it was a town where it's all meat and potatoes. Yet my family, when I ate at home, what did we eat? We ate Korean food. So it's rice, it's fish, it's kimchi, fermented foods, it's garlic. These are foods that you know what they come from. Like they look like the plant or the animal that they came from. Whereas then I would go out to eat with my friends and we go to McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's and stuff. And you'd eat these ultra processed foods where you don't even know what they're made out of because they don't look anything like their original food form. The interesting thing is, you know, I mentioned earlier free radicals and antioxidants. Fried foods and ultra processed foods actually are filled with free radicals, believe it or not. And so a lot of people don't realize that those types of foods, because they've been so ultra processed, that they actually will develop free radicals and that can be damaging to your health in that way as well. And so simple things like trying to stick with real whole foods when possible, understanding that, you know, hey, my daughter has a birthday party and we're having cake, then I'll eat the cake too.
Sure.
Okay. You have to live. But at the same time, if you are looking for optimal health, then some very simple steps is try to focus more on those real foods and a little bit less on those ultra processed ones.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to think about the way our families, like when you come from an ethnic background, like there's things that we do that are probably so anti-inflammatory. So we have curcumin, or we have turmeric in all of our food, which curcumin is like all the rage right now.
Oh, yeah.
We have ginger, garlic, and everything. We often have yogurt with every meal, or with many meals, we'll have plain yogurt, and that has a lot of probiotics. Oftentimes, it's very cultural to go for a walk after eating dinner, which is great for reducing blood sugar. So there's just so many things that we do habitually that are beneficial that have come from ancient teachings.
And unfortunately, the standard American diet and the American lifestyle now has lost all of that. I mentioned kimchi, you mentioned yogurt. Really, when you look at, there's very few fermented foods that are in the standard American diet. Yes, there's yogurt, but that yogurt that we have is very different than the yogurt you probably grew up eating. You know, this is filled with sugar and not necessarily the same type of health food. And the idea behind the benefit of fermented foods is that they're filled with beneficial bacteria that can help the bacteria in your gut, which is your microbiome. And really, the only other time really that in the standard American diet that people eat fermented foods is like if you are at a barbecue and you have a brat and you put sauerkraut on it. But yeah, really, that's it.
So rare.
Yeah. And so really, that's something that really is missing. And so that's one of the things I do recommend. I briefly mentioned supplements is to take a daily probiotic, at least 3 billion colony forming units a day, because our diet is so devoid of these fermented foods. When I grew up in my parents' house, we had fermented foods almost every day with kimchi. Now, we had miso, that's fermented. Tempeh is fermented. So there's so many other options, but the American diet just doesn't have it. Like, it's essentially sterile.
Yeah, there's really not much. And then the other thing, you know, you mentioned in your book, and I've heard this before, is that the soil quality from what our foods are coming from is really poor. And you mentioned a study in the book, and that was really fascinating. But basically, they've looked at soil quality. It's just like 70% less diversity or 70% less quality nutrients in the soil than there was in the past.
So it's an interesting thing. If you follow alternative health experts, they'll tell you that the soil quality is different. Industrial farming practices have depleted the soil of nutrients. And so our fruits and vegetables are not as nutritious as they used to be. And that's one reason why some people encourage people to eat organic, because there are some studies that actually do look at organic fruits and vegetables versus conventional and showing actually a higher nutrient profile. Not enough that if you can't afford organic, then by all means, eat conventional grown fruits and vegetables. It's better to eat it than not to. But at the same time, you know, there was a study that you mentioned. It was a study from 1950 to 1999 looking at conventionally grown fruits and vegetables and found it a reduction in six different nutrients, three of them being ones that to me were alarming, and that would be iron, vitamin C, and protein. When you're finding that you have a reduction in the nutrients in our fruits and vegetables, then it gets you concerned about, okay, what do I do? And that's why I'm a fan of supplements. The fact, though, is that you cannot out-supplement a bad diet, okay? And so you always want to focus on, once again, eating the real food, eating the rainbow of fruits and vegetables, eating a lot of healthy protein, especially as you get older. But at the same time, you add some supplements in there. I recommend a multivitamin, a fish oil every day, the probiotic. I also recommend collagen. Most days you can do that because I think that's really good for the skin as well. I think ideally you start going towards that optimal health that we really wish for everybody.
Yeah, tell us a little more about collagen. You wrote a lot about it in your book, and I found it very interesting. I didn't actually know that ingesting collagen was good for you.
Yeah, so collagen makes up 70 to 80% of our skin. And that is a part of our skin that causes our skin to feel tight and to be smooth and youthful. And we lose about 1% of the thickness of our collagen every year, starting about in our mid-20s or so. When women hit menopause, it increases to up to 2% a year. And that's one reason why, you know, you see women who maybe are in their 70s and 80s and their skin can be tissue paper thin and they can even tear just from like a scratch. And so one of the things we want to do as we get older is make sure that our skin continues to retain that collagen. So then the question really is, does it make sense to take collagen orally or should you just put it on your skin? Well, collagen is a large protein. And the fact is that if you apply it on the surface of your skin, it's not going to do anything because the skin is a barrier and it will not absorb that large protein. You're wasting your money on essentially an expensive moisturizer. But what happens if you take collagen by mouth? So the naysayers will say that it's a large protein. And if you take it by mouth, your body will absorb it on its own. There's no guarantee that that's going to make your skin better. And a lot of doctors believe that. And in fact, there is a cardiologist, real nice guy. He's got a big bushy beard. He's probably in his mid-60s. He also has a nutrition degree. And he made a video a couple years ago basically stating that collagen supplements don't work. You might as well just have gelatin. And some of that comes from the idea of bone broth. Mm-hmm. And when bone broth cools, it becomes gelatin that's pure collagen. So he made this video and I saw it and I'm like, oh, I really like this guy. You know, he comes out with great information, but I'd have to disagree on this one. And literally like a month or a few weeks ago, I saw that video pop up again. Before the video ended, you can see him. He swipes the video away and he goes, I was wrong. And I did the research. I looked at the studies and collagen supplements do work. And I was floored because how often do you see a physician, especially this is a guy who comes across very professor-like and very assured in his opinions and stating things as fact, saying that he was wrong. And I applaud him for that. So really, when you look at the science, okay, some people say, well, do collagen supplements really impact your skin? How do you know if you take a collagen by mouth that your skin's going to be better? A lot of studies prove it. There was a meta-analysis back in 2021. It was something like 1,200 or 1,400 people that took a collagen supplement for 90 days and found a statistically significant improvement in the quality of their skin and the thickness of their skin and the hydration of their skin. There have been studies performed. These are prospective, randomized, clinically controlled trials where they put people on a collagen supplement and they have actually biopsied their skin afterwards and found an improvement in a thickness in the amount of collagen. So there's a lot of studies, and these are studies that are typically, a lot of them are placebo-controlled, randomized, clinically controlled trials. These are like the gold standard, and they just show it. And that's apparently what this doctor saw. So really, do collagen supplements help? I do think that they do. I want to be full disclosure. I have my own collagen supplement. It's our top seller, and we sell a lot of it. And the stories that I hear from the people who buy it and who use it are just outstanding. I mean, it's fascinating. To the point where I send it to my mom, basically every couple months, I just send her a couple of tubs of it. And a few weeks ago, I was visiting her and my mom's like 78 and she was making me breakfast one morning and she was like, Tony, my hair's getting thicker. Do you think it's that collagen that you're sending me? And I'm like, well, I think it could be, Mom.
That's all.
Collagen is something where it's not a substitute for daily protein intake. Okay, so you don't want to use that in exchange for your day's protein, but it's a very simple supplement to take. You know, just like going off gluten, it's something that if you're not vegan or vegetarian, then I encourage you just try it. Try it for a couple months and just see how you feel. See how your nails are. See how your hair is. See how your skin is. People tell me that they have joint issues that get better because, you know, part of, depending on the collagen supplement you'd have, you know, type 2 collagen or type 3 collagen, it's in joints. And so that can help with that as well.
That's awesome. That's really great. I will probably be buying some collagen supplements. So tell me, you know, I loved in your book that you made skincare super simple. You were like, these are the very few things. And of course, there's very individualized things. But if you had to say, like, these are the core things you have to do, you basically made it super, super simple. So you want to share?
Yeah, sure.
Some of those things?
So really, I call it the 2 minutes, 5 years younger skincare routine, because we put people on this very simple skincare routine and found that after 2 months, they would look upwards of 5 years younger. And we actually polled people online and say, okay, how much younger do you think these people look? And the average was about 5 years. So it's very simple. Okay, you don't have to do a ton of different steps. You don't have to do a Korean 12-step skincare routine. Every morning, you want to start by cleansing your skin. Use a cleanser appropriate for your skin type. So if you've got oily skin, then go for more of a foaming cleanser. If you've got drier skin or sensitive skin, then a more milky or hydrating cleanser will work better. After that, apply an antioxidant serum. Vitamin C is the most common one, and most skincare lines have a vitamin C serum. Ideally, if you want to biohack and be a little more aggressive, then use a vitamin E serum as well, because there was a study that showed if you combine vitamin C and vitamin E, both of them are powerful antioxidants, that they work synergistically together to give you an even better beneficial effect. And then I do recommend a sunscreen at least SPF 30. Now, our dermatology friends will tell you that even if it's cloudy outside, even if you're sitting in a dark basement all day, you should apply sunscreen. I encourage you, you know, there's something therapeutic about getting the sun on your face. I live in Michigan, and in the middle of February, when the sun comes out, you'll see me getting the sun on my face because it's therapeutic. So, you know, do what you feel is best for you. But as a plastic surgeon, I see people come in my office with skin cancer. It can be devastating. You do not want to get skin cancer on your face. So apply sunscreen, at least SPF 30. That's all you have to do in the morning. Cleanse, antioxidant serum like vitamin C, and sunscreen.
I love it because that's exactly what I do.
Oh, perfect. Okay. So evening time, what do? Cleanse your skin. You have to cleanse your skin in the evening. If you only wash your skin once a day, your face once a day, do it at night because you've got to get rid of the day's worth of sweat and grime and dust and dirt and pollution. And if you've got makeup, then a lot of people will double cleanse, ideally with like an oil-based cleanser. You can start with that. So you start by cleansing your skin. And then I do recommend at that point afterwards to use some type of a treatment. The one that we usually recommend is a retinoid. So retinoids basically are derivatives of vitamin A. Prescription strength is retin A. Non-prescription strength is retinol. And most big skincare companies have a retinol moisturizer. And I think I gave you one in the bag I brought with me. So that is going to be, if you ask dermatologists and plastic surgeons, what is the best anti-aging cream to use? That's the most tried and true. However, there is a small percentage of people that just don't tolerate it well. And if that's you, if you've got real sensitive skin, then there's a different one you could try called Bakuchiol. That's made from a plant called the Bobchi plant. And there was a study that compared retinol to Bakuchiol head-to-head and found very similar results, but with a little less skin irritation with the Bakuchiol. And then if you want to apply a moisturizer on top of that, that's fine. But moisturizers are not mandatory. If you've got oily skin and you don't want to put a moisturizer on, then don't. That's okay. And that's all you have to do at night. You cleanse, use the retinoid, or if you want to go with a Bakuchiol, that's fine. Moisturizer is optional. And then what I recommend is once a week, if you have sensitive skin, maybe twice, up to three times a week, if you have quote unquote normal skin, to exfoliate your skin. You can do that using a gentle scrub, or you can do that using, let's say, an alpha hydroxy, like a peel, a light peel. The idea behind exfoliating is you get the immediate effect where your skin's going to feel smoother, but you also get a cellular effect, where when you exfoliate the skin, it sends a cellular signal to the deeper layers of skin to turn over more quickly and to get that skin more revved up. Because as we get older, the skin turnover slows down and we want to rev that skin turnover back up for more youthful, healthy skin.
That's the only thing out of all the things I don't do regularly because it's not daily, so I just forget to.
Yeah, you're not alone. I'm not the best with that myself sometimes.
Yeah. So last, I just want to talk a little bit about hair loss. You did mention PRP injections being helpful. What about there's like red light headbands or red light for your head or other things that you found useful?
Yeah, so really the first step if you've got thinning hair would be to look at the nutritional deficiencies that may contribute to it. So you could see a dermatologist. Sometimes they will actually draw labs and stuff. But for me, I go for the easy thing. There are all-in-one hair supplements out there. There's Nutrafol, there's Viviscal, and others that you can try. And that's a first step. Is just take these supplements. They have different things in them from biotin to vitamin D to zinc and other types of nutrition deficiencies that could contribute to hair loss. That's the first thing. Second thing is stress. Stress can contribute to hair loss. So if you're in a really stressful time of your life and you're finding that your hair is thinning, then I would encourage you to do some stress release activities. I have a lot of them in the book, from meditation to yoga to gratitude journals and a lot of different things you can do. After that, I would recommend doing just what you mentioned would be red light therapy. Essentially what it is they're helmets that have lasers in them that are called low light lasers or cold lasers, where they don't work with heat. But the idea is that laser energy is transferred to the follicles of your hair, causing your hair to go into a growth phase. And that's what you want to see. So I wear one myself. It's called the iRestore, and I wear it. It's 30 minutes every other day. And I just wear it while I watch TV or read a book or scroll my phone. And there are a lot of studies that show that low light laser therapy can really help with hair growth. The other thing that you want to consider would be some type of a topical. You know, if you want, you can go with a pharmaceutical like minoxidil, can work very well. There actually was a study that compared topical rosemary oil to minoxidil for thinning hair and found very similar results, except the rosemary oil had much less scalp irritation. If you want to use a pharmaceutical, super easy, go get some minoxidil at Target or your local department store, grocery store. The other option would be to use rosemary oil. Just make sure if you're doing that, if it's a rosemary essential oil, you want to mix it with the carrier oil first. You don't want to just put essential oil on your scalp. That's too strong. And there are some commercially available rosemary hair oils that are already mixed for you. So those are kind of the basics. You know, there are other things you can do that are invasive, like PRP injections. That would be the next step if those things don't help you. Then that would probably be the next step that I would recommend.
Well, good to know, because I also use one of those red light helmets, and I think it's
you do.
Great. Yeah. I mean, I think it helps.
Yeah. I mean, your hair looks great to me. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This has been super educational and helpful. And everyone, please buy Dr. Yoon's book. Really, it was a great book to read. It's something you can go back to over and over again. There's recipes in there. There's all sorts of stuff. So it's really wonderful. And please let people know where they can find you. I'm sure they already know.
So the book is at autojuvenation.com. And if you order the book or pre-order it, depending on when you watch this video, you can get a bunch of free gifts. We have a recipe book. We have actually a coupon for my online store if you want to get skincare and all of that. So we've got over $100 in free gifts to people who order the book. Otherwise, I'm all over social media, and I do have my own podcast called The Holistic Plastic Surgery Show, which I need to have you come on at some point as well.
I love that. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on today's podcast. If you enjoy our content, please be sure to leave us a rating or review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. You can also support us by following us on any social media platform, including YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, or others. Another wonderful way to support us is by joining our membership, where you'll have access to show notes of every podcast episode, as well as AMA episodes where you get to ask the questions that I answer. And as always, take care of yourself because you're worth it.